deep roots are the way forward. And that is something that we're doing across our entire breeding programs, both in amenity and in agriculture.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Phil.
And this is The Underground, the podcast for garden sector professionals. Each week, we discover the trailblazers and innovators who are shaping the future of garden care in the UK. So, without further ado, let's get down and dirty.
So we're delighted to welcome onto the show this morning, Guy Jenkins, the consumer manager from DLF Seeds UK.
Good morning. Good morning.
Guy, welcome to The Underground.
Welcome back too. Thank you very much, Phil and Kate. Good morning. Good morning.
Guy, can we kick off just by asking you if you could give us a little bit of background about yourself and how you've ended up working for a seed company?
Yes, of course. So, yes, I'm the consumer manager for DLF UK. And I'm responsible for supplying grass seed into the gardening market via the Johnson's Lawn Seed brand and through various own label customers. Okay. I'm also the treasurer for the trade body GEMA. Keeps me occupied too. But okay. I've been with DLF for 28 years. I know. I didn't mean to stay that long. But anyway, I started in the professional amenity market before moving into the consumer business about around 20 years ago. And how did I end up at DLF? Well, some of my colleagues do actually ask the same question. But so I used to work with somebody who actually joined the business, and there was a vacancy going, and he suggested I apply.
Right.
So I did, and then 1996, I ended up there. I actually didn't think I'd be here this long, but you know, things change.
Wow. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there about the professional amenity business within DLF. Mm. Obviously, we're interested in the garden side of the business. Can you just tell me about how those two parts are connected and what the crossover benefits between the two parts of the business are?
Yes, I can. I think it's fair just to give a slightly broader intro on that one, just to see how things fit. So basically, DLF UK has three main parts to the business. One is agriculture, which supplies grasses to UK farmers, amongst other things, but fairly self-explanatory. The professional amenity side, to which you've just referred, and that is supplying sports turf venues, for example, football, rugby, golf, tennis. You'll have heard of a lot of our customers. Not sure I can broadcast it, but you know who sort of people I'm talking about. We also supply landscapers with landscape grasses and flowers, all sorts of requirements, industrial parks, land reclamation, road verges, this sort of thing. And then we have the consumer department. And obviously, we're supplying shops and online, but the grasses we use come from the amenity side of the business.
Right.
So we breed our own grasses. 10% of all employees are employed in R&D. That's over 200. Yes.
Wow.
It's a lot of people. And we have two distinct programs, one for agricultural grass mm-hmm. and one for amenity.
Right.
And the two, they are absolutely aimed at completely different things. So amenity grasses, they want to be low growing, dense, you know, lots of leaves, amongst other things. So the grass we use in our mixtures are sourced from the amenity breeding program.
Right.
And the great thing about that means that we have the data from our trial sites about which grasses perform best in the UK climate. And in addition, we get a lot of data information from the professional amenity market about what works.
Right.
So we can incorporate new coatings, new treatments and new cultivars that have already proved successful in the professional market.
Right.
And that's how we feed into the new product development for consumer.
Right. So do you do those trials in the UK as well? Because is it a Dutch company? Is that right?
It's a Danish company.
Danish company, right.
We do actually have quite a big operation in Holland, to be fair. Mm-hmm. DLF is a Danish cooperative. And we have trials and demo and breeding sites all around the world.
Right.
So in Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere. So we also have trial sites in all the main markets in Europe. So we have a trial site in Gloucestershire, not far from where we're based, and it's got 14,000 different trial sites. I think it's the biggest in the UK. It's huge.
Yeah.
And so we're trialing grasses, agricultural grasses, of course, and amenity grasses. And so we can see exactly which ones perform best. And for instance, we opened up a trial site, breeding site in Ireland, and you'd think there's not that much sea between us. Okay. But, you know, the grasses, this is more in agriculture, to be fair, but the grasses perform differently in Ireland than they do in the UK. Right. So it's a really important part of it. And not only that, I can actually get in the car, drive down the road and see for myself. So we know what works and we know what doesn't work, but some of the stuff is out there too. Right. So, which is quite handy.
Can I just ask, do you supply other brands? So your actual seed?
Yes, we do. Right. So the grass breeding is a very expensive long-term business. So we have breeding programs for other customers, to which I have no access.
Right.
Because that would be quite wrong. So there's, was it in finance? They call them Chinese walls, I think, but it's not quite like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, we have DLF varieties available to the UK amenity business and consumer business. And we have varieties that aren't available to us because they're being bred for other people.
Okay.
So we supply other brands. We supply other DIY retailers, mm-hmm. online retailers, all sorts of people.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that feeds into my next question, which is, Sir Johnson is the consumer-facing brand name of the lawn care business.
Yep.
So what makes a Johnson's lawn seed so unique?
Well, I think Johnson's is probably the oldest lawn seed brand in the UK, and I'm maybe the world too. I'm not sure about that. But its real strength actually is its modernity. So each mix is designed for a specific purpose. We do not use the same mix and just change the box, right. which you can see from time to time.
Right. Surely not.
I can possibly say. We do use modern varieties, and in particular some of our newer perennial ryegrass in our mixtures. It's used in professional sport and turf, and it's drought resistant. It's resistant to dog pee, which is an interesting one. Very high score for something called nitrogen use efficiency. Now, there's a good bit of jargon coming in there, but what it means is that the ryegrasses that we are developing and using in our mixtures can grow quite happily without fertilizer.
Right.
Right. And in fact, when we trial things with high nitrogen, medium and low, when it's no nitrogen being applied at all, the roots of these grasses just keep going down and down and down and down.
Right.
And they hunt out the nutrition. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is that we're very consistent. So we don't change the percentages in our mixtures very often at all. But all we do is change the cultivars as they improve.
Right.
So customers can buy the mixtures year in, year out, and they'll only get better. And that's a great thing.
Right. So there's been quite a backlash on kind of social media and about ryegrass for home gardens. Do you, you see that as an issue, or is that something that's kind of Chinese whispers, as it were?
This is a good question, actually. There really is an awful lot of nonsense about this, and I don't understand why it's coming back. Because grass breeding is so far ahead of where it was 20, 30 years ago. And they're even using perennial ryegrass on golf courses. I know that's highly managed turf.
Yeah.
Where they use fescues and bents as well. But in your lawn, ryegrass, good ryegrasses are fantastic. They really work. Yeah. So perennial ryegrass, as going back to the breeding programs, you've got agriculture and you've got amenity. Agricultural ryegrass is horrible, ugly, darn stuff for feeding cows, sheep, etc. If you put that in your lawn, you'll end up with an open sward that grows like nobody's business. There are some suppliers out there who even use annual ryegrasses used for production of hay, silage, etc.
Okay.
Because it's cheap, mm-hmm. and they put in lawn mixtures. That's really nasty stuff.
Right.
The grasses, the perennial ryegrasses we use are amenity bred varieties, and they are designed to be low growing and dense. Now, if you look at the tables for the BSPB, or used to be called the STRI tables, they actually rate perennial ryegrass for lawn use, not just wear and tear for football, but for lawn use. Mm. And these modern ryegrasses are very fine leaved, as I alluded to earlier. They are very good at getting a little bit of nutrition out of the soil and continuing to grow. So I think the reaction against perennial ryegrass, we had it 20 years ago.
Right.
To have it again today, it's it's old news and actually it's very, very out of date. Very out of date.
Could you just give us a quick definition of ryegrass? You know, so what you would describe as ryegrass?
Right. Okay. So in Latin, it's Lolium perenne. Okay. And it's a bit like a racehorse. If you know the names, then you can work it all out. But so a Lolium perenne could be a particular name, might be an agricultural ryegrass, or it could be a fantastic amenity one. You can't tell from the Latin. Okay. So Lolium perenne is quite responsive to nutrition. Traditionally, it's not as tolerant to drought and shade as fescues. But the newer varieties coming through are. That is the thing.
That's the key.
So our new varieties of perennial ryegrass coming through in amenity have a root mass 30 or 40% bigger than the preceding grasses. And roots are, it's fundamental to how these things perform. So you'll always get a slightly coarser leaf with a perennial ryegrass compared to a fescue.
Okay.
But the key thing in that question is that we use mixtures. There's only one mix I have that uses two perennial ryegrasses because they're both resistant to dog pee. Okay. Right. The other mixtures, and that's proven, we've done a lot of research. The other mixtures are combinations of fescues and perennial ryegrass or fescues and bents on their own.
Right.
And with a lawn, you have lots of different environmental stresses. And if you use a mixture, some of the grasses will prosper, some of them will fade away, but you end up keeping a nice green lawn.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if it's wet, if it's drought, if it's close mowing, something will persist. That is the key. That's why we use it.
Ah, okay. Got you.
So talking about drought and weather and waterlogging, what else have been consumer kind of needs that you've seen?
So in terms of changes, if you sort of dial back a few years, a lot of people perceive the lawn as just being symmetrical stripes, you know, emerald green bays,
yep.
You know, attack that daisy with a knife, you know, get it out, whatever you need to do.
Yep.
And I think we have seen a shift away from that. There are plenty of people who want parallel lines, you know, that's fine. But the lawn itself and the perception of how it looks and how you use it has changed. So, you know, if you let other plants join in the act, you end up with more color, you end up with textural differences in how it appears, and you actually bring in more wildlife.
Yeah.
Also, Nomo May is a good example.
Yeah.
You can have a lot of fun with that. I wouldn't recommend people let the whole lawn go because you might still need to use it and you need to, you know, mow it slowly down to the height that you want it to afterwards. But, you know, there's lots of things you can do with it. And even a lawn that is regularly mowed, you know, every 10 days or whatever, is actually really good for wildlife.
Yeah.
And the cut heights will change the wildlife that uses your lawn. Mm-hmm. So if you have the opportunity to change cut heights across a lawn area, you'll get different wildlife in different parts.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So, yes, and of course, we have seen the artificial grass coming in. I think we're actually witnessing it going out again. I don't think you'll ever get rid of it.
No.
But I think if somebody put black plastic sheeting over their lawn, they wouldn't like it. Just because it's green doesn't make it better.
Absolutely. I like that. That's a great analogy.
Yeah, it's not ideal. No, it's not. And you get microplastics. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that there's been legal cases about claiming it's eco-friendly.
Yes.
It really isn't. Mm-hmm. But I think lawns actually have got a real future, particularly with the new varieties coming through, mm-hmm. but also robot mowers. These things are brilliant.
Yep.
They cut the lawn regularly, just a tiny bit. They actually end up making the leaf width finer. They actually reduce the ingress of weeds, yeah. And in terms of carbon footprint, it's less than you and me pushing a lawnmower around. It's tiny.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite interesting, you mentioning there about carbon footprint. I was just wondering whether you've done any studies on the carbon capture of lawns.
Yes, we have. I don't have those stats right in front of me this second, but ryegrass, clovers, fescues all do trap CO2. And the figures, I'm trying to remember now, but it's tons per hectare. Okay. Right. It's a very significant amount. And it's on a par with trees. Okay.
Wow.
Now, going back to roots, we're jumping around a bit here, but basically the deeper the root, the more carbon that you trap. Yeah. Because it's the top, I think it's the top 3 meters of the soil has more CO2 or more carbon in it than the whole atmosphere, 3 times as much. Okay.
Yeah.
So the deeper your root goes into that layer, even if the grass on the top dies or disappears, that root structure is still there and it's trapped the CO2. So yes, we do have figures. I don't have them right in front of me, but you know, by having a grass in your lawn rather than plastic, you're trapping CO2. You're not actually generating it with the production of a plastic mat.
Yeah.
So could you say that's then negated by using a petrol lawnmower every week?
Yeah, it might be, yes. I mean, I suppose it would depend on the size of your lawn. We're back to, you know, forms of propulsion here. Electric lawnmowers are, the footprint is tiny. Mm-hmm. And actually the footprint of electric mowers is less than you or me pushing one.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's an analogy here that if you and I are riding side by side on a bike, mine's electric and yours isn't, my carbon footprint is considerably lower than yours because you're propelled by, you know, chicken breasts and lettuce or whatever it is. And you know, most of my energy is coming from renewable electricity. And so petrol mowers are on their way out, just like petrol cars.
Yeah.
Hence the comment about the future of lawns, I think, is actually pretty secure.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
That's really interesting. Really interesting. So you've mentioned about some of the innovations that you're currently working on at the minute. Can you just tell us a little bit more about some of those things? I mean, you know, the top secret stuff, that's what we want to know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're slightly overlapping. We've touched, carbon sequestration is one of the big things we're looking at. Okay. And we run a program called Radimax in Denmark, which trials the root depth of grasses and other plants to get thrown at it. And basically, it's a huge trough, okay, V-shaped with a lid over the top that lets sunlight through but not rain.
Okay.
And then in this V-shaped trough, if you imagine from the sides down to the bottom, I think it's about 3 meters deep, we have pipes with holes in that let water out. And then what you do, I can't remember how wide it is, but it's, you know, 3 or 4 meters, something like that. And then you sow the grass plants across the top, left to right. And so the ones on the edges, the water is immediately available for the roots. It's there right away. But as you go across the middle, you've got to go down 3 meters to find the water. So we're now finding grasses that have enormous roots that we didn't know about. Okay. So we're able now to incorporate those into our breeding program. And when it comes to climate change, even in the cool season climate, you know, the UK is not going to become a desert. It's going to become warmer and wetter probably, with periods of intense drought. Deep roots are the way forward. And that is something that we're doing across our entire breeding programs, both in amenity and in agriculture. If you like, it's all about the rhizosphere or the underground, so to speak, if you want. It's
excellent.
It's all about that.
We like that.
Yeah. We're also looking at grasses combined with microclover as well. And that really enhances that effect. It has a big impact on that.
Interesting.
The other thing we're looking at, there's another one I've just remembered. Some grasses let in less moss.
Ooh. Yep.
I know. And so we've got some trials running now with individual cultivars, but also mixtures to see which ones actually let in less moss. And I can't give you all the whys and wherefores. That is a commercially bit sensitive.
But this is an actual grass rather than, you know, mow your lawn more, you make your lawn thicker and therefore it keeps out moss. So you're talking about this as an actual species that is better at keeping out moss than just regular maintenance.
Ooh. Species and cultivars of those too.
Right.
So we're finding things that, work like that. So that it's a little bit down the line, but that is one that we're working on too. But yeah, it's a good one.
Interesting. So within the industry, is there one type or characteristic of a lawn seed that would be considered as the holy grail that you're all, that you're all trying to get to?
Yeah, there is. So really a cultivated variety. It's a portmanteau word. That's two words joined together. So a cultivated variety. Okay. So a cultivar of grass, basically, that looks good. That's got to be a starter in the amenity, isn't it? It's got to tolerate cold. Mm-hmm. It's got to tolerate heat. Mm-hmm. And it's got to tolerate drought. And ideally, other stresses like wear. Okay. And the other thing about it is that it has to yield a decent amount of seed in production. Otherwise, it's too expensive to sell.
Right.
And that is a key part of the breeding program.
Yes.
So we're getting closer. Some of the new perennial ryegrass varieties we're using have those characteristics, this extra root mass, the tolerance to heat and drought. We have one particular kind of perennial ryegrass, or there's a number of cultivars, but particular type of perennial ryegrass. And it's used in Norway and Sweden because they love it. It doesn't die under the snow. And they're using it in Spain, Portugal, Italy, because it tolerates the heat.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're getting to that point. Yeah.
Oh, that's really exciting.
It is. Yeah, it's good.
We're going to take a short break. But in the meantime, it's time for Kate's Corner, where we discover the musings and sage advice from the Gardener Guru. So, Kate, what have you got in store for us this week?
Well, today, Phil, because for me, the sun is shining and the insects are buzzing around my garden.
Lucky you.
I'm going to talk about creating a pot for pollinators.
Lovely.
So if you have a small garden or even a big garden, you know, you can do your bit for biodiversity. So all you need is a container, and it can be anything. You can use your imagination as long as you can put a hole in it. It doesn't matter what you use. You know, you can use a traditional terracotta pot. I'm using at the moment an old one of those, you know, the tub trugs, the buckets, the colourful buckets, that had a split. So I've put a bigger hole in it. So anything you like, as long as it's got a bit of size to it, you know, 30 centimetre diameter is really good. And then what you want to do is put some crocks over the bottom. Now that is kind of to help with drainage. I think we've talked about this before. And you know, for people who are renting, you know, who maybe move quite a lot and can't really plant up a garden, or if you've just got, you know, a concrete patio, then if you put in some old black plastic pots, you know, the ones you're buying your plants in, that maybe are split, because, you know, I know we try to recycle as much as we can. So I've got lots of split black plastic. So, and put them in the bottom, because what that does, not only does that help with drainage, but it means your pot's a lot lighter to move around with. Also, you need slightly less compost. Don't tell the manufacturers that. So it makes it a wee bit cheaper. So then you want to think about your plants. So most plants for pollinators are really, really pretty. And everyone goes on about native, but don't worry about that. Things like Verbena benariensis, scabious, lavenders, all sorts of herbs, marjoram, they're really, really good for insects. But don't just think about the pretty bees and butterflies. Think about the not so attractive ones. So if you are planting something white, that is amazing for moths, because moths come out at night, the white will glow and that attracts them, especially scented white plants like Nicotiana. They can be really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
And then maybe pop in a grass, one that doesn't get too big, because then you're providing habitat for other insects. So don't just think about the bees and the butterflies. And then you can also put some stones around the top. You can put a bit of bark around the top, maybe some twigs, some cut up bamboo, which is hollow inside. So you're creating a whole kind of mini habitat in one pot.
I love that.
And get a saucer next to it and fill that saucer up with some pebbles, and then put a very shallow layer of water. And then that's a really good water station for bees and butterflies, and they won't drown in the pond either.
So colour, scent, and also whites for the moths.
Whites for the moths. Don't forget about the moths. I'm not talking about the cabbage white that devastate your cabbages, but all the other moths that are really essential for doing that pollinating job too, and we often forget about them.
Brilliant. Top tips then, Kate. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
And back to the show.
So following on, there's a lot of interest, not just within lawns, within gardens, plants, whatever, about working with native species and the local environmental conditions. Is this something that you research, our native species?
Yes, it is, very much so. but there are some important semantics to consider here.
Right.
Using native species is not the same as using native grasses.
Right.
And we need to be really careful that people don't think that they are harvesting native grasses. So just to give you an idea, so
yeah,
we've talked about we're a grass breeding company. We breed what are called cool season grasses. So not the stuff that grows in Africa or wherever. It's the temperate zone stuff. There's about 160 grasses native to the UK. We're not breeding all of those, thank goodness. Yeah, it's there's a limited number that we're breeding. So, for instance, red fescues, sheep fescues, hard fescues, perennial ryegrass, of course, brown top bent, just to name a few. So we use all of these in our lawn mixtures, and they are all cultivated varieties from our amenity breeding programs. Okay, we trial them in the UK, as we've touched on. So I don't need to repeat that bit. The difference is native grasses are hand mechanically harvested from special sites and then multiplied up to be sold on as maybe companion grasses to wildflower mixtures.
Right.
Or, and this is something we do, is we hand harvest wildflower seed and grasses, multiply them up, and then re-sow them to repair the damage from a road project or whatever's going on.
Okay.
So native grass is different from native species. Okay. Mm-hmm. You could have a native red fescue grass that you've hand harvested and multiplied up. So when people are buying native species, they must be under no illusion that they're buying something that's been, you know, carefully sieved out from a, you know, wildflower area in Worcestershire somewhere, right, and then multiplied up. Yeah. And that I think people need to know, because I think there's a little bit of
No, absolutely.
Difficulty about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
Does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, really good. Really interesting. So are there any surprising things that you think consumers wouldn't realise about development of grass seed?
Yes. Well, it's a very long process, and it's not expensive, I think, would be the polite way of putting it. So to the time period from a programme, the breeding cycle is about 15 years.
Wow.
Goodness.
Yes. So the new grasses, that are coming into the marketplace now, were probably started in the late 90s. Okay? And so you could start off with tens of thousands of different genotypes, and you may only end up with a few marketable varieties from this. The great thing about grass breeding in Europe is that it is a process that is protected. So every new variety that comes out has to have what's called DUS. It has to be distinct, uniform, and stable. So in some countries, you can basically take someone else's grass, I'll grow it, and I'll call it Guy's grass, not Phil's. And there's nothing you can do about it. Sorry, tough luck. Okay. All right. But in Europe, we're able to essentially patent our genetics.
Right. Okay.
And that actually makes the market far more beneficial to the consumer, because there's always an incremental improvement to the grasses coming through. And, you know, we don't steal people's grasses, but you can't have rogues coming in, taking your genetics, because it's identifiable. And so, no, sorry, you know, your new variety is actually almost identical to so-and-so's. You can't sell it.
Okay.
Job done. Yeah. So that's a good way of customers across all the markets, agriculture, professional amenity, and consumer. Mm-hmm. They know that over time, it only gets better, and it is unique. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we do. And then in terms of where do we get this stuff from? So some of our breeders go out in the field, out in the wild, as it were, and they get what we call ecotypes. So they'll go around on hands and knees, and they'll find grasses that are doing things. It might be an area that's been subjected to wear for 400 years by goats walking over it or whatever it is. It might be we found some fantastic fescues near Mont-Saint-Michel in France.
Right.
Some of those were so good, we just multiplied them up. We didn't need to cross them.
Good.
For instance, most of it does go in.
Okay. Amazing.
We can trial grasses. So we think we get a bunch of grasses and think, well, we want to find something that's wear tolerant. So we subject a whole family of grasses to wear, and the one or two or three or 10 that survive that will be the ones that go into the breeding program. So you're effectively creating your own pool there. Mm-hmm. And of course we cross plants like all breeders. I mean, the process, DLF's over 100 years old, I think, it's been doing it that long, but cultivating varieties in the UK has probably been going on for centuries, just on a local level, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So yeah,
That's really fascinating. So it must be really hard, though, because you spend all these years breeding lawn seed and then you kind of hand it over to the consumer, who then kind of will chuck a load of artificial fertilizers on top and scalp it. And do you have any kind of aftercare advice, or is it just literally you produce the grass seed, you hand it over, and then you kind of just hope they make the best of it?
Walk away. Yeah, fingers crossed. So we do actually try and put some good solid information on the back of the box. That's a starting point. And we do that for grasses and wildflowers. Also, the website has, you know, some pretty useful information out there. And also, we do get customers calling us up saying, oh, what do I do with this? What do I do with that? And most of the time, we're able to answer that. And if we don't know the answer, we always know somebody who does. I mean, this is the point about the depth of expertise in the business. So no, we don't just hopefully cross our fingers and walk away, but it is a live product. Yes. So you can do all the right things and the weather doesn't help you and it's frost or drought or wind or something and it doesn't work first time. So no, we don't just abandon them.
So as well as lawn seed, are there any other products that you create for home gardeners?
Yes. So we actually produce our own native wildflowers. We've just recently moved our production around. So we're actually growing the stuff at our head office site. I think it's about 25 acres. I could be wrong, but it's quite a lot. Yeah. And we have, we're also producing on local ground as well. Mm-hmm. And we're really lucky actually, because we've got two experts at this working for DLF, and they're sourcing native wildflower seed from conservation areas, clearly with permission, and so it's all, you know, legitimate and above board. I sneak in there at night with a plastic bag. I mean, the key thing is knowing about the provenance of the seed. You know, if it's a wildflower meadow, you know, we have the historical records going back centuries, knowing that it's never been cultivated. These are wildflowers that made their way in. We can use these, and also there are techniques to ensure that your stock of wildflower seed maintains its biodiversity, and we're employing those too. So yes, we do that, and we supply into the professional immunity market, of course.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I know we're really concentrating on the garden side of things. I've got a quick question about the professional amenity business, and you were saying there about you supplying lots of maybe football clubs or whatever. Do they ever have like very specific mixes that, you know, a blend which they specify that they want?
Yes, they do. We have some standard mixtures in professional amenity, as you might expect. But some of our football customers, golf customers, like to have their own specification. We supply turf growers who supply Premier League clubs. Mm-hmm. Have to grow the damn stuff in secret locations, otherwise I think people will be in there and say, yeah, well, they'll be digging it up, you know, who wants a bit of Manchester United in the back garden, you know, that sort of thing. So someone does, I'm sure. So we supply Stadia into Ireland as well. So yes, we do. We put together mixtures on demand. I mean, special mixtures, we call it. So not a problem at all.
That's really interesting. Mm. So if you could give the home gardener one tip for how to look after their lawn, what would it be?
It would be very simple. Don't mow it too short. Okay. That is the key thing. You know, you can cut it to 40, 50 millimeter, you know, 1.5, 2 inches, something like that. And the more leaf, the better. Obviously you don't want it around your knees, but you've got bigger surface area for photosynthesis. That bigger surface area aids root development, and we've touched on that. You know, if your roots are going fine, what's going on the top will follow. It's also more tolerant to shade, drought, wear, everything. So obviously you've got lawns, back to your symmetrical stripes, you know, where people have a cylinder mower and they'll mow it 2-3 times a week, like a bowling green. That's fine. It is very stressful for the grasses, and you know, over a period of time, one or two grasses will predominate, but eventually people have to oversow, which is what they have to do in golf greens and bowling greens all the time, basically. So don't mow too short, best way. And it's good for shade too.
Top tip.
Brilliant.
Excellent.
Heard it here, folks.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about what it is you enjoy about working in this industry, but I also want to know, what is it that led you to become part of GEMA? We've talked to a few people now who are in GEMA, including Vicky Nuttall and Kate Evans,
right.
And they all seem to love it. That's not putting any pressure on you to say that you love it. But,
gosh, I hope they're not going to listen to this one.
I've just put a lot of pressure on you. I'll rephrase that.
No, you're fine.
What is it about GEMA that made you want to become treasurer, I think? Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so I've been a member of GEMA for donkey's years. Can't remember how long. Probably 20 years or more. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I always used to go, I always went to the meetings, the AGM, and I think I was one of the few sad people who always asked for the accounts just to make sure that my money was being used properly and all the rest of this stuff. And I actually was interested in joining before, but resisted it, thinking, oh, I'm not sure I want to be involved in a trade body. You know, it's people just having a quick chat and a cup of coffee. Well, I'm totally wrong. Vicky asked me to join as treasurer. Obviously, you have to be accepted. You can't just walk in there. And fortunately, I was accepted to go onto the council, and it's been a real eye opener. It's very, very interesting, the work that goes on, the benefits to members. It is not just some little cabal that's, you know, squirreling away in an anti-competitive manner or anything like that. Not at all. We actually have an anti-competitive statement, you know, beginning of every meeting. And if nothing at all is discussed that is remotely commercially sensitive within or without, and it's all for the benefit of the members. It's actually very, very interesting and very worthwhile. It's I wish I'd done it before. It's very good.
Okay. And what keeps you in the industry, in the horticultural industry itself? Because you said you've been with Johnson's quite a long time now.
Well, I think for starters, it is actually the people. I know that sounds a bit trite, it is true. Well, almost all of them anyway. And just, but it's
mentioning no names,
of course. It's the variety of customers too. You know, we're dealing with small garden centres, you know, owner managed garden centres, right up to very big international businesses. Quite varied in how to handle customers and how to supply them. But also, one of the things that's kept me in the business, you might guess this, is actually the company I work for. I didn't expect to be here this long. And one of the reasons I've stayed is because it's a very enjoyable place to be. It's a very dynamic business. It grows with the market. So it's a combination of the market itself and the business I work with. I don't think I could actually separate the two out from that, to be fair. But yeah, it's fun. That's the key thing.
Yeah, good. That's good to hear. So do you, this is the key question, do you have a lawn yourself?
Oh, I do. Yes, I do indeed. Yeah. You can ask me anything about my lawn. Go on, far away. Please.
How long have we got? Do you have a robot mower?
Do you know, I've trialed some robot mowers for some people and I don't have one yet. The one I trialed didn't work too well and it kept falling in the same hole. And I'd get a little message on my phone saying, you know, there's some issue. And I'd pick it up and I'd move it to another part of the garden. And 5 minutes later, it was down the same hole.
Oh, no.
so it was too small, I think, the wheels. But where I got it working on one of the areas, it was a revelation. Honestly, it looked great. You don't have to do anything. It's silent. And, you know, you don't have to get up on a Saturday morning. Yeah, it's dry. I'll do it now. It really is the best. But no, I have a petrol mower, if I can confess to such things. I've got an electric one too.
So you're a lawn geek, we love
yes,
it.
Yes, yep.
And do you enjoy other types of gardening or are you just lawn?
No, I do enjoy the lawn, yep. I do enjoy the other gardening. We when we moved here, it was basically some sort of green canyon. It was a huge non-native hedges, lots of Lalandia literally crowding out the house. They've all gone. The hedges are gone. I've replaced them all with native broadleafed hedges. I've created wildflower banks, put in a decent-sized pond, What else have I done? Ooh.
It sounds like you live in a stately home.
I don't. I don't know. But we raised beds. I put in raised beds. We've done a bit of lawn leveling too. It's not a stately home, but I won't charge you to come in. It's fine.
But do you think you'd have done all this had you not been involved in the industry? Was it the industry that got you into gardening, or were you keen before?
I think actually the industry has got me into it. Honestly, you wouldn't have found me dead in a garden centre before this.
Right.
And now I go into and I'm like, ooh. and I end up going to, I don't know if it's an age thing, maybe it is, but I end up in all parts of the garden centre, starting with a lawn seed, of course, and then moving around. But no, the garden's given us real pleasure. Both of us, and it continues to do so. So it's something we will carry on with very much.
Oh, that's fabulous. Lovely. So have you got a garden tool or a gadget that you couldn't do without?
I'm tempted to say a wine glass, actually, but...
Well, why not?
Hey, I love that.
Yeah, wine glass. Seriously, the best thing I've ever bought is a still combi tool. It's one of these things with a lightweight four-stroke on the back, and it takes... a hedge cutter, a chainsaw, strimmer, even a cultivator. And I've had it for about 20 years and I could not have managed the garden without it. And it's still going strong. Brilliant tool. Yeah.
Right.
Wonderful. Yeah. I think we need to get some money from Still because quite a few people are recommending them.
Maybe we should get them to sponsor the podcast.
Yeah, why not? So they can make a wine glass for me as well. That'd be good.
Yeah.
And just finally, Guy, do you have a plant or a flower that will always put a smile on your face?
Do you know, I thought about this and I think to narrow it down to one would be tricky, but there is a theme. There is a theme. And really, it's about the arrival of flowers after winter that makes me smile, because probably like a lot of people, you get a bit miserable after Christmas and you're just waiting there. And one of the first things I notice is winter aconite, these little yellow blobs appearing. I'm thinking, yes. And then, I mean, that's followed by snowdrops. I've got marsh marigolds in the pond that suddenly just go bang and they're all yellow. Wonderful. And then in the woods, we've got wood anemones and bluebells, which I think probably the bluebell is the one I'm most fond of.
Yeah.
And then finally, and this is very sad, I love watching my hedges grow green because it makes all the effort worthwhile. So there you have it.
Excellent.
No, I do get that. For me, I love the bright green of the beech leaf on a hedge as it's coming out, that zesty green. It's here.
It is here, that's right. So I do have beech, copper beech and hornbeam. So it's different colours. And in the autumn time, it's actually riotous. It's reds and oranges. Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, just want to say thank you so much, Guy, for joining us today. It's been thoroughly enjoyable talking to you and really enlightening as well.
Great.
Absolutely.
I've enjoyed it too. Thank you for asking me on. And
thank you.
All been very good.
As you said, Phil, that was really, really enlightening. Who knew so much went into grass seed breeding?
I know. Well, what I love about these episodes of the podcast in particular is the fact that the people we speak to are just so enthusiastic about something which actually on the face of it, you go, oh, it's just grass. But there's so much to learn and so much going on. It's just fascinating.
You know, sounds a bit geeky, but I think it's fascinating. I really, really do. And I hope lots of people have listened to it and know a bit more about, you know, this whole creation of a lawn.
Yeah, I mean, you think about all that information and all that research that's gone into it.
How long it takes.
Yeah, 15 years. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a long-term project.
Absolutely, absolutely. Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed talking to Guy.
Brilliant.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the underground, sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Bara, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at writeobara.com.